You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is the combined issue for December of 2022 and January of 2023, and this is Vanity Fair, Part B. Here's the continuation of Incident to Service by Maximilian Potter. The history of the Fears Doctrine reads both as a quirk of American jurisprudence and one continually unfolding injustice that traces its way back to the waning days of World War II. On Saturday morning, July 28, 1945, Lieutenant Colonel William F. Smith, Jr., a decorated combat pilot, took off in a stripped-down B-25 bomber from Massachusetts, bound for Newark, New Jersey. Smith was to pick up his boss, a colonel, in Newark, and return to South Dakota, where they both were stationed. The weather that day was bad. Air traffic control directed Smith to delay his takeoff time. Smith, a West Point grad who had a reputation for being cocky, ignored the air boss directives. In New York airspace, Smith found himself in dense fog with close to zero visibility. When he emerged, he was flying hundreds of feet above, or rather through, Midtown Manhattan. A guest reported seeing the bomber pass the 22nd floor of the Biltmore Hotel. In Smith's attempt to pull up, he crashed into the 79th floor of the 103-story Empire State Building. Smith and two military passengers, one who had hopped a last-minute ride, died instantly. The crash also killed 11 civilians, who were among the few people working that Saturday morning. The tragedy was big news, and as the media reported more information about Smith's recklessness, the public demanded justice. Government officials, working through Congress, attempted to provide compensation to the civilian families to settle the matter, but some families wanted to file lawsuits in federal court. They ran up against the doctrine of sovereign immunity. Sovereign immunity had been in place since the nation's founding. That principle held that the federal government is a sovereign power and therefore could not be sued. Claims against the U.S. federal government were then handled, as much as they were, on a case-by-case basis, fielded and more or less adjudicated by Congress. There are a couple of remarkable things about that arrangement. One, the legislative branch assumed responsibilities of the judiciary. And two, the founders allowed the notion that the king could do no wrong to take root in America. A year after the crash, public pressure compelled Congress to pass the Federal Tort Claims Act, in which the federal government waived its immunity to lawsuits with 13 specific exceptions. Among them, the act barred any claim arising out of the combatant activities of the military or naval forces or the Coast Guard during time of war. In layman speak, if you're in the military and you get hurt or die in activities related to battle, that's a risk that comes with the job. What the FTCA did not bar from a possible tort claim against the government were injuries due to negligence or wrongful death sustained in a military context unrelated to combat. Or so it seemed, until 4 years later, when Fears versus United States reached the Supreme Court. Next photo, a long road. Delbarba in the hospital in March 2019, the month after contracting a flesh-eating bacterial infection that resulted in the loss of half of his left leg. Last winter, around the same time I visited the Delbarbas, I joined Army Green Beret Richard Stasekel for what was outwardly a joyous moment. Staskel, who served with distinction as a Marine before enlisting in the Army, was then nearing 20 years of decorated military service. He and his wife, Megan, and their two teen girls were about to move into a newly constructed home. During one of the days I was with Staskel, the builders were pouring the cement for the driveways and path to the front door, and the contractor invited the family over to imprint their hands. It was just a few days before Thanksgiving, and unseasonably warm in the rural wooded area near Pinehurst, North Carolina. Sunlight flickered through tree leaves that fluttered in a breeze. I asked Megan if she wanted me to take photos of the moment. "Please," she said. Staskel went first, placing a hand in the cement at the edge of the driveway. Then Megan, then each of their girls, Carly and Addison. As the ritual unfolded, a sadness suddenly arrived, like an uninvited guest. No one spoke a word of it, but it was there, quiet and heavy in the air. Staskel's new house had been funded by the nonprofit Operation Finally Home, which provides homes and home modifications for gravely ill and injured military veterans or their families. Although the Staskels would be together in their new home that holiday season, barring a miracle, the day was imminent when Megan and the girls would pass by those handprints, and 40-year-old Sergeant First Class Staskel would be forever gone from their lives. That day at the new house, Staskel was dressed in a hooded sweatshirt with the logo of his Army Special Warfare Training Group, shorts, and a weathered ball cap. He was all smiles and appeared every bit the fit warrior. Like many Special Forces operators, he had an unruly beard and exuded gung-ho energy and optimism. Staskel is not one of those people who cannot sit still. He can, and he did so, during the many hours we talked about what was done to him, and as we talked about what he has done about it. There's no question, however, that he prefers to be in motion, ideally on some kind of mission. Within 3 minutes of meeting him, he told me this himself, and asked if I minded jumping in his pickup with him while he ran errands. "What else am I going to do, just stay home and die?" he said. "That's not fun. I've got plenty of time to do that." Staskel's resilience is no facade. It's part of what enabled him to survive the combat he faced in Iraq as a Marine, and then return for more as an Army Green Beret. Unlike Del Barba, Staskel told me that when he was 19 years old, he was kind of lost. A freshman in college, he didn't enjoy school and he was doing poorly. He wasn't from a military family. He was born and raised in San Jose, California, and got the idea of enlisting while watching the movie U-571. The film is set during World War II. A crew of Americans takes over a German sub. The scene that got Staskel was one in which an American sailor sacrifices his life to save his crew. "It wasn't like I wanted to see people die, especially people I know and am friends with," he said. "It was just so admirable that somebody was willing to give their life for others. I wanted to be amongst those people that have that thought process, that they would if they had to. Before I knew it, I was in the Marines." A year later, it was 2004, and Staskel was in Iraq. One of four Marine snipers on patrol, outnumbered and taking heavy fire. The ongoing Battle of Fallujah had flushed enemy insurgents out of the town. Staskel's sniper team was on the outskirts near the Euphrates River. Tipped by a local, the insurgents came at them with RPGs, machine gun fire, and their own sniper. Staskel's team radioed for backup, but everyone was engaged. They'd have to hold out for now. The insurgent sniper got Staskel with a shot that entered his left side where the body armor wasn't. A corpsman rushed to him and lay by his side as the enemy ran their way. Staskel could see them coming. Couldn't have been more than 40 yards away, shooting. With his good arm, Stasekel propped his rifle on the magazine and emptied it. The way he figured, there was no way the corpsman could drag him out of there without getting killed, too. It was just a matter of minutes before the enemy would reach them. Stasekel grabbed his only grenade, held it on his chest, and told the corpsman to leave. "I wasn't going out alone," he told me. The corpsman said he wasn't going anywhere. Recalling this, Stasekel choked up. He took a minute and continued. He heard somebody yell, "Everybody stay down," and then he said, "You just could hear it getting louder and louder, the whoop-whooping of the blades of Marine choppers that laid down the fire that ended the firefight." Stasekel had been shot through the lung. While he was transported from Iraq to the U.S. military hospital in Germany, he flatlined at least twice. But before the end of his 4 years in the Marines was over, Stasekel made a full recovery. Despite wanting to stay in the Marines, he honored his mother's pleas and left at the end of his enlistment. Back home in 2005, Stasekel was earning good money working with his father's contracting company. He returned to school and put up with the civilian world for as long as he could. "I don't know if I gave it a chance, or I didn't give it a chance," he told me, "but it wasn't working for me. I'd be sitting there listening to people complain about things, and I'm thinking, God, wouldn't some of my buddies give anything to be able to complain instead of being dead? I wanted to go back to what I knew and what I loved and where I felt like I fit in." By then, he had met Megan. Within 6 months, they were married, and Megan was pregnant. Stasekel also had been trying to get back into the military. He was still only 25, and a highly decorated combat vet with a Purple Heart and a Bronze Star. He says the Marines didn't take him back because he left the Corps, and the Navy rejected him because of his pre-existing injury. In July 2006, he went off to Fort Campbell in Kentucky and began his career as an Army infantryman with the 101st Airborne Division. In no time, he was selected for Special Forces and earned his Green Beret. He was deployed on Special Ops many times over and twice more to Iraq. Ribbons, badges, medals. Stasekel will shrug it off, but he earned a bunch. By 2015, Stasekel was assigned to the 1st Special Warfare Training Group at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, and later selected to attend Special Forces Underwater Operations School, which required him to complete a dive course. Because of the injury to his lung, he first had to get a CT scan. On January 27, 2017, Stasekel says a physician at the Womack Army Medical Center reviewed his scan and cleared him. At dive school in March 2017, Stasekel could barely finish. He had trouble breathing. "Everything was hell," he told me. "Simplest of tasks were difficult." For the first time in his military career, Stasekel failed to qualify. He began coughing up specks of blood. He didn't think it could be anything serious. After all, he'd been given a clean bill of health from Womack 2 months earlier. Stasekel's breathing challenges intensified. He had to sleep with his torso elevated. If he attempted to sleep flat, breathing was a chore, and he would have nightmares of drowning. By May, he felt so bad at work that he went to a base clinic. A nurse recommended he be transported by ambulance to Womack, where he had been scanned and cleared in January for a more thorough exam. After X-rays, a doctor came to him. "We reread your scans from January," is how Stasekel recalls the conversation. "We think we see something, but I'm not a specialist." The doctor informed Stasekel he would refer him to a pulmonologist. Within days, the specks of blood that Stasekel had been occasionally coughing up were now more than that. He tried to get his appointment moved up to no avail. On May 22nd, he was at work at Fort Bragg and felt so bad, his commanding officer cut some red tape and got Stasekel to a civilian hospital. Still, it wasn't until June 20th that Stasekel got a CT scan there. It showed a mass on the upper part of his right lung. A week later, Stasekel returned for a biopsy. The prep and procedure gave him flashbacks to the hospitalization after he was shot. I remember the nurses saying, "You'll be all right." And then I woke up and I remember Megan was crying. He had stage 3A lung cancer. I was like, "So what?" The so what was at 36 years old, Stasekel learned he was terminally ill. While he and Megan were in one of the first meetings with a civilian pulmonologist, the doctor asked, "Why didn't you come in sooner?" Stasekel was puzzled and responded that he came as soon as he could. The civilian pulmonologist had obtained Stasekel's CT scans of the previous January, 5 months earlier, from Womack. He informed Stasekel and Megan it clearly showed Stasekel had a tumor in his lung. Stasekel recalls the doc looking him in the eye and saying, "So you're telling me nobody told you? I am a doctor, and I don't like the word suing, but you should be suing the crap out of somebody for this." The pulmonologist explained to Stasekel that if he had begun treatment for his tumor in January, his chance of survival would have been 90%. Now his prognosis was a few months to a couple of years, if he was lucky. In May 2019, a spokesperson for Womack Army Medical Center told the Fayetteville Observer they were committed to providing the highest quality care in the military health system. "We continue to support SFC Stasekel in his ongoing medical treatment." When I spoke privately with Megan, I mentioned that despite everything, her husband appeared to be genuinely upbeat. "Yeah, he's a pretty upbeat guy," she said. She paused, holding back tears. "But he has his moments. Like the other night in bed, our heads are on the pillow and it's just us looking at one another. And he takes my hand and he'll say, 'I'm not ready to die. I don't want to leave you and the girls.'" Stasekel soon learned that the cancer had spread to the left side of his neck, in his lymph nodes, spleen, liver, pelvis, right hip, and spine. He was now stage 4. Just as the pulmonologist advised, Stasekel and Megan began contacting lawyers. Just like the Delbarbas, Stasekel says he was told that he had no legal standing to sue. When Stasekel learned what fears was, the Marine sniper who propped his gun, emptied his magazine, and grabbed the grenade, that, Stasekel, made up his mind that if he was going to die, he was going to take out the fears doctrine with him. Fears versus United States was one of three similar cases that had worked its way to the Supreme Court, which consolidated them for consideration in 1950. The plaintiffs in each were either active-duty military members or the family of a decedent killed while on active duty. The primary defendant in all three was the government. The first suit was filed by the family of Army Lieutenant Rudolph Fears, who died in a barracks fire caused by faulty heater wiring. Fears' widow alleged officers who put him in the barracks knew, or should have known, the heating plant was defective, and further, that the barracks fire guard on duty the evening of the fire was also negligent. In Jefferson versus United States, a soldier underwent an abdominal operation and suffered post-op complications. In a follow-up procedure, surgeons removed from the soldier's stomach a towel 30 inches long by 18 inches wide. It was marked Medical Department, U.S. Army. The final suit, Griggs versus United States, was brought by the widow of Lieutenant Colonel Dudley Griggs, who alleged her husband's death during surgery had been caused by negligent Army physicians. After hearing arguments, the court ruled against all plaintiffs and dismissed the cases. The majority opinion, authored by Justice Robert Jackson, harnessed the phrase. Jackson wrote, "The government is not liable under the Federal Tort Claims Act For injuries to servicemen, where the injuries arise out of or are in the course of activity incident to service. Essentially, even non-combat injuries or malpractice suffered by military members could not form the basis for a lawsuit. If Congress had wanted to allow such claims, the court determined, it would have made that more clear in the language of the Act. The Fears Doctrine was born. In the 7 decades and rulings since that foundational court opinion, Fears has united a broad, bipartisan swath of judges and legal minds who cite it as an example of staggering judicial overreach. From their perspective, the ruling is a quintessential example of activist judges legislating from the bench. Divining Congress's intent rather than abiding the statutory text as written. In a dissenting opinion regarding a Fears Doctrine case before the Supreme Court in 1987, Justice Antonin Scalia wrote, "Fears was wrongly decided and heartily deserves the widespread, almost universal criticism it has received." In that dissenting opinion, Scalia joined with the 3 liberal judges on the court, Justices William Brennan, Thurgood Marshall, and John Paul Stevens. Scalia closed their dissent with an impassioned expression of anger over congressional failure to act. Since 1950, the Supreme Court has considered 7 Fears Doctrine cases. Though each case had its unique nuance, all of them essentially rehashed the same core issues. And yet, in nearly every case, the court added to or otherwise tweaked the previous precedents as the basis for dismissing the new claim before the court. If there is any consistency, it is that nearly every opinion on a Fears-related case has petitioned Congress to amend the torts claim law. These considerations, it is said, should persuade us to cast upon Congress, as author of the confusion, the task of qualifying and clarifying its language, the court wrote in its 1950 decision. The Fears Doctrine doesn't only bar service members from filing medical malpractice claims against the Department of Defense. Existing precedents make it virtually futile to file other actions, too, such as those that might arise from harm and death resulting from alleged negligence. On April 22, 2020, Private First Class Vanessa Guillen was bludgeoned to death by Specialist Aaron Robinson on base at Fort Hood, Texas. He then dismembered her corpse and buried the pieces along the banks of a nearby river. Robinson died by suicide before he could be arrested. Before her murder, Guillen told her family that she had been harassed by a supervisor, not Robinson. In December 2020, the Army's own investigation found that officers at Fort Hood had created a permissive environment for sexual assault and sexual harassment at Fort Hood and disciplined 14 officers. The Guillen family has filed a suit. But despite the culture of dereliction of duty and willful negligence, Fears makes achieving justice nearly impossible. In May 2021, the Supreme Court declined to hear another suit brought by a former West Point cadet who claims she was raped on campus and that the Army failed to deal with a pervasive and well-known culture of sexual violence at the academy. In a statement issued by the cadet's legal team, one of her attorneys said, "No service member should ever be told that their rape is incident to service." Next photo, the good fight. Stascoll in the hospital in 2018, the year after a civilian doctor told him the military had misdiagnosed his by then terminal lung cancer. When he decided to pursue a lawsuit, Stascoll was told he had no standing to sue. The most recent medical malpractice Fears-related case to reach the Supreme Court came in 2019. Lieutenant Rebecca Daniel, a 33-year-old Navy nurse, died in 2014 following a massive postpartum hemorrhage at the Naval Hospital in Bremerton, Washington, within hours of the birth of her daughter, Victoria. A district court barred her family's malpractice claim, citing fears, and the Ninth Circuit Court regretfully affirmed. The plaintiff, Daniel's widowed husband, petitioned the Supreme Court directly, asking it to overturn fears. In May 2019, the court officially declined to review the case. Justice Clarence Thomas wrote a dissenting opinion that quoted Scalia's language from 1987 and bluntly chastised Congress for failing to clarify the FTCA language. Thomas went further. Such unfortunate repercussions, denial of relief to military personnel, and distortions of other areas of law to compensate will continue to ripple through our jurisprudence as long as the court refuses to reconsider fears. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg did not join in Thomas's dissent. However, she wrote that she, too, would have granted review. The same month of the Daniel decision, Des Delbarba was in a hospital undergoing one of his 40-plus skin grafting procedures, and Richard Stasekel was assessing the battlefield to take aim at the fears doctrine his way. Stasekel had begun working with a Florida-based attorney, Natalie Quallum. Stasekel's mom, Kitty, had Googled her way to Quallum's practice, the whistleblower law firm. As Kitty told me, I figured, well, Richard is a whistleblower. Quallum doesn't have a personality. She is a personality. Get her talking and she just goes. The F-bomb is one of her favorite words. When Richard's mom sent that email, I didn't know what the F-fears was. Never heard of it, she told me. I was disgusted by what she told me. I looked fears up and thought, this doesn't make sense. This case should be a slam dunk. By the time Coam met Stasekel, she had experience with cases against the likes of the Department of Homeland Security and the Drug Enforcement Agency. I thought maybe Richard hasn't been talking to the right people, Coam said. Then she contacted a colleague who had a wealth of experience in malpractice cases. He says, poor guy is screwed, she recalled. You only got one of two chances, an act of God or an act of Congress. Coam decided she'd take Stasekel's case. I felt so much sadness for his situation, she told me. I let my heart lead in this case. Stasekel and Coam had followed the Daniel case, but neither was optimistic given the 70 years of precedent to go on. Coam instead proposed they push for a bill in Congress. I had no idea what she was talking about, Stasekel said. During the spring of 2019, while the Supreme Court considered ruling on the Daniel case, Stasekel, with Megan by his side, walked into the Rayburn House office building in Washington, D.C., to appear before the House Subcommittee on Military Personnel, chaired by California Representative Jackie Speier. Fears is the product of judicial activism and Congress's silence, Speier said in her opening remarks. This hearing essentially was Coam's Plan B. Plan A had been to get the Senate Judiciary Committee to consider clarifying the language of the FTCA, which would essentially overturn fears. They had tried for months. They hustled meetings with members of the Republican-controlled Senate Judiciary Committee. The majority of Republicans on the committee were supportive, but they all said the same thing. Nothing was going to happen without the backing of Lindsey Graham, then the chairman of the Senate Judiciary, who refused to see Stasekel. So Coam walked Stasekel to the Democrat-controlled House Armed Services Committee. It was more important to get something through than it was to fight something you couldn't fight, Stasekel told me. Coam thought they still might be able to get a bill passed that would not directly address fears, but that would put into place a process that would allow active duty service members to have a chance at something approximating justice. What Cawam had in mind was modeled on the workers' compensation process, a system of claims and reviews. The point of Stasekel testifying was to educate the members and generate media attention and public support. With Megan and Cawam seated behind him, he laid out a summary of his story. He held it together pretty well until his close. His voice cracking, he said, "The last thing I want to say is, this does affect me, obviously, but my children are definitely the true victims along with my wife. The hardest thing I have to do is explain to my children when they ask me, this doesn't make sense, how is this happening? And I have no good answers to give them. I say, that's why I'm coming up here, to help convince these folks in Congress to change this." Another witness, Paul Figley, testified to the Department of Defense's perspective on why FEERS is necessary. From 1991 to 2006, Figley was the deputy director of the Department of Justice office that handled all tort litigation. Figley argued against any change to FEERS, stating that the military already offered its members death gratuity benefits, subsidized life insurance, free medical care, and compensation for service-connected deaths. If Congress overturns the FEERS doctrine, Figley said in his prepared remarks, injured service members could obtain their benefits from the military compensation system and then seek out tort damages. They or their attorneys would argue in our adversarial court that someone in the government was at fault for causing their injuries. Having members of the military litigate about who was at fault for a training accident, ill-fated combat mission, or surgical procedure would disrupt the relationship of mutual trust necessary to an effective fighting force. 5 months after Stasekel's testimony in September 2019, a bipartisan bill co-sponsored by Speer was referred to the Senate Judiciary Committee. The bill emerged with bipartisan co-sponsors. In December 2019, the SFC Richard Stasekel Military Medical Accountability Act of 2019 became law. The gist of the act looks like this. Each branch of the military assigns an attorney or attorneys to field claims from its members. The alleged malpractice must have occurred in a Department of Defense medical center, hospital, care center, or a DOD-covered health care provider. Claims must be filed within 2 years of the alleged malpractice. However, in order to accommodate Stasekel's case, claims filed in 2020 for events in 2017 are eligible. Payments of up to $100,000 are made by the DOD. Larger payments are made by the Treasury Department. Any damages will be less the payments from other existing service member programs, such as group life insurance, death gratuity, the survivor benefit plan, and VA disability compensation. What Stasekel and Cawam accomplished is potentially seismic. For the first time since the 1950 FEERS decision, Congress, in effect, has acknowledged that harm or death caused by military medical malpractice outside of combat situations is not incident to service, and that victims do deserve to be compensated for their pain and suffering and loss. According to information the DOD Office of General Counsel included in a presentation this past February, as of December 31, 2021, the total number of Stasekel Act claims filed in the Air Force was 105, in the Navy, 101, in the Army, 149. Only two settlement officers had been accepted by claimants. Both of those were Air Force, one for $20,000 and another for $10,000. According to Cawam, no claims had yet been paid. Under the Stasekel Act, non-economic pain and suffering compensation is capped at $600,000. The compensation cap is just one of the things that Stayskull doesn't love about the act that bears his name. He is proud of the work he did to get it passed, but he will be the first to tell you this new process is not nearly the justice active duty service members deserve. That, he said, will only happen when the fears doctrine is abolished. What troubles Stayskull and victims like him and their families most is that without the ability to sue, there is no discovery process to compel the DOD or the government to produce documents or information. And without that, there can be no accountability, and without accountability, there can be no justice. The last night I was with Stayskull, we talked on the back porch of his parents' place in Pinehurst. Megan waited for us to finish so we could go to dinner. I did all I could, Stayskull told me. My hope is somebody will pick up where I left off, expand on it, get fears reversed. I probably won't be alive to see it, but that's my hope. I mean, why do we forego all of the rights that we fight for? All the rights that I say I am defending, that you have asked me to instill in other countries. Why do I lose those? His smile. Dez Del Barba has got one of those smiles. When he smiles, you can't help but smile. When I arrived at his parents' home last winter, I talked first with Mark and Kamny, and Dez swung by after he got off work before heading to his apartment. He's 25, but could still pass for a Lincoln High School student. It's the boyish face. He's got his mother's dark hair and dark eyes, the kind of face that his grandmother, who's in the other room watching TV, can't help but squeeze and kiss. She's done that a lot in recent years. Kamny, too, of course. Perhaps that happens more frequently, more intentionally, when you almost lose your child. Dez walked through the front door, and Kamny got up, wrapped her arms around him and squeezed him close, a side hug. She leaned into him. He wore an army green T-shirt with the logo of his basic training company, black shorts and sneakers. Pretty much what he wears to the gym. Kamny had sent me videos of him working out. In the photos taken of Dez shortly after his diagnosis and throughout much of the 8 months of the skin grafting and amputations, you might have thought he crawled away from an IED explosion. Today, except for the black prosthetic from the knee down, there's not a visible sign of what he survived. On a pain scale of 1 to 10, Dez says, 10 doesn't come close to doing it justice. The actual grafting part, the nerve damage is so severe, you don't feel that as much, unless they are taking out the staples. The flesh-eating infection had ravaged Dez from the waist down. The skin doctors used to replace that skin was taken from donor sites on his chest and back. So I was in the uncomfortable position with skin taken off of my upper body, Dez explained, and then laying down on this thing like a net thing that stuck to the flesh. The flesh that the net stuck to was my back. So I would get up, and it would rip off more skin and blood. That was the most painful out of everything. Imagine that feeling you get when you experience a paper cut, but only constantly and all over your body. That's how a doctor explained to Kamny what Dez experienced. It took well over a year for Dez to physically heal enough to begin to restart his life. He finished his degree, and when I met with him last winter, he was new to a tech sales job. He had his own apartment not too far from his family. As far as emotionally healing, that's ongoing. During the first 8 months he spent in the hospital, with the procedures, the amputations, watching the toll it was taking on his parents, thinking about his girlfriend Julia and what a future would look like, he said, I kind of thought every night before I went to bed, tomorrow I'll wake up and I'll be back in college and I will have my normal life again, and it never came. As soon as he got out of the hospital, September 2019, he got some fentanyl, and with it attempted to end his life. In his drug-induced stupor, he answered the nightly FaceTime call from Julia, and she immediately called 911. Afterward, he spent time in a psych ward, in therapy with other service members. His perspective changed. I saw kids there that were there because they didn't want to be in the Army anymore. It was too mentally tough on them. Maybe the drill instructor was yelling at them too much, or the barracks buddies were too mean to them. I'm there because this happened to me. I was like, I'm stronger than I think I am. I just picked myself up and I stopped worrying about what my old life was. I started thinking about what my life can be and what my life will be. I still have shit days, man, where I lay down in bed at night. Last week, maybe, or 2 weeks ago, I'm like, F, why the F? I've literally lost athletic ability. My body looks totally different than what it was before. My mental toughness is totally different than it was before. But that's it. I just have to keep going. Des would hear his parents talk about fears beside his hospital bed, and eventually he Googled it. He couldn't believe it was real. But then he was focused on getting through the day. This past March, 3 years after Stascoll testified before the House Committee on Armed Services, Des DelBarba walked into a hearing room and did the same. Des and the DelBarbas still want answers, still want accountability for what happened, not just to Des, but to countless other active duty U.S. military personnel. They want fears abolished. Here's part of what Des read from his statement. Today, as I sit in front of you all, 3 years and 19 days have passed since I contracted necrotizing fasciitis at Fort Benning. And I still have no clear answers on the status of any quality assurance investigations that may or may not have been initiated promptly. What happened to me did not have to happen. This was preventable. If I was your son, if I was your brother, if I was your loved one, would you sit stagnant waiting for answers? I would hope not. You'd fight for their rights, and you would never stop until the questions are answered and the responsible people are held accountable. Hall of Fame, Hollywood director and Rolling Stone veteran Cameron Crowe is taking his rock movie classic Almost Famous to Broadway. By Michael Rydell, with photographs by Sebastian Kim. Opening photo shows the cast. "Go fishing," Cameron Crowe's mother Alice said on a sunny September day in 2019. Crowe, the Oscar-winning screenwriter and director, was reluctant to go fishing. A few days earlier, Alice, age 97, had fallen out of bed, and he wanted to be on hand in case she needed anything. But he had a day off from grueling rehearsals for a new musical he was about to open at the Old Globe Theater in his hometown of San Diego, and he'd planned to take some colleagues out on a boat. "I'm going to be fine," his mother insisted. "Have fun with your people, and this year it's going to be great. I'm so happy." So he went fishing. There was no cell service out on the Pacific, but when the boat came into dock, Crow's phone lit up. His mother had gone into cardiac arrest and was in the hospital. The prognosis wasn't good, but attendants told Crow, "This woman is a fighter." That, he knew. "There's a play about to open at the Old Globe about just how much of a fighter she is," he told them. "Then we've got to keep her alive," an attendant said. The play was Almost Famous, a musical adaptation of Crowe's 2000 autobiographical movie about a 15-year-old aspiring rock journalist. Crowe, in 1973, freelancing for Rolling Stone. Stillwater, the band he's profiling, and the teenager's loving but fiercely protective mother, a widow who fears rock and roll will trap her son in a hell of drugs and degeneracy. Derailed by COVID-19 for 2 years, Almost Famous opened on Broadway at the Bernard B. Jacobs Theater in November. It features a young, multi-ethnic cast of newcomers. A group of actors so sexy that they remind some old Broadway hands of the original cast of Rent. Look for Solea Pfeiffer, Casey Likes, Chris Wood, Jana Jin Jackson, Emily Skultice, and Julia Cassandra to light up The Great White Way. When it comes to acting, when it comes to casting, Crowe, 65, knows what he's doing. Almost Famous made stars of Billy Crudup as Russell Hammond, the handsome lead guitarist of the mid-level rock band Stillwater, and Kate Hudson as Penny Lane, the band's chief groupie, or, as she prefers to think of herself, its muse. But it was Frances McDormand as the mother, Elaine Miller, who stole the movie with such lines as, "Rock stars have kidnapped my son," and her 11th commandment, "Don't take drugs." Crowe's mother, a college professor and social activist, loved the movie, but she was even more excited about the musical. She'd been a devoted theater-goer ever since she saw Marlon Brando in the original Broadway production of A Streetcar Named Desire. When Crowe was growing up in San Diego, practically across the street from the Old Globe, she took, or rather dragged, him to the theater. She would say, "Let's go see these Shakespeare plays. You'll brag about it later," Crowe recalled, and I was like, "No, I won't. I want to stay here and try and sneak rock music into the house while you're gone." While Crowe was falling in love with Joni Mitchell in the early 1970s, his mother was championing Stephen Sondheim. Stephen Sondheim, especially his musical Company and her favorite song from the show Barcelona. "You have it all in this song," she told her son. "You have sadness and romance and humor and character." It took Crowe nearly 40 years to get to the theater, detouring through Hollywood with movies such as Fast Times at Ridgemont High, Say Anything, Jerry Maguire, and Vanilla Sky. But when he finally got there, Alice was thrilled. Though dependent on a walker and requiring friends to help her get around, she reserved 3 seats on the aisle for the entire Old Globe run of Almost Famous. Crowe's original draft of Almost Famous, the movie, had nothing to do with his mother or his teenage years, covering bands such as the Allman Brothers, Led Zeppelin, and the Eagles. Russell is modeled on Glenn Frey. The story was about a British publicist. Crowe wrote the part with David Bowie in mind, who represented a British rock band. There was a young reporter, but he was a minor character. Then, in draft after draft, the publicist got smaller, and the personal story of the reporter got bigger, Crowe said. It was like the personal was driving the story every step of the way. As Crowe was writing his movie, Austin Powers' International Man of Mystery was released. It was kind of burlesquing the British stuff, Crowe recalled. So he ditched the British band and invented the Midwestern band Stillwater. Brad Pitt was originally going to play Russell. Meryl Streep was approached to play Elaine, and Kate Hudson signed on to play Anita, Elaine's rebellious daughter. At the time, Hudson was a rising star. Harvey Weinstein was already trying to get Kate into romantic comedies, Crowe said, and I think people were whispering to her, "You're playing a small side part in this movie. You're not the star." And Kate said, "I promised Cameron I was going to be in this movie. I love this movie. I'm going to play this tiny sister part." When Pitt and Streep decided others would be better suited for their roles, Crowe met with Steven Spielberg, whose company DreamWorks, along with Vinyl Films, was producing the movie. "The script is the star," Spielberg told him. "Who's the best actor for these parts?" Crowe immediately thought of Crudup, just then getting some attention in Hollywood. Crowe also sent a script to McDormand, who had just won an Oscar for Fargo. She wrote back, "I would love to be in your love letter to Rock." When Sarah Polley, cast as Penny Lane, withdrew, Spielberg advised, "Cast Kate Hudson." Next photos, casting call. The musical's creator, Cameron Crowe. Crowe with the ensemble, Rob Coletti, Annika Larson, Drew Gelling, Chris Wood, Solea Pfeiffer, and Casey Likes. They say sometimes you get the cast you deserve, and that's the one case where it actually came true, said Crowe. To create the character of Elaine, Crowe dug into a cache of letters and aphorisms his mother had sent him over the years. Her pithy sayings, commands really, inspired many of McDormand's famous lines. Over dinner at Orzo in Manhattan not long ago, Crowe handed me a folder containing some of Alice Crowe's meditations, mostly written in capital letters and all signed M. "These could be embarrassing for me," Crowe said. "Cameron, you're in a rut. Reinvent yourself. Take a risk. Face your fears and they dissolve. See, noble son who elevates humanity in a dark, hurly-burly world, please speed up casting. Start directing, and the joy will come. To my noble son, re-diet. Did you exercise today? I love you. P.S. Face your fears and they will back down." Alice frequently visited the set during the making of Almost Famous. Crowe begged her not to bother McDormand. "I turn around 30 seconds later, and she's got Frances buttonholed," he said. McDormand handled the situation deftly. "Alice," she told Crowe's mom, "Elaine is not going to be you, and it's not going to be me. It's going to be somebody else." In the end, Alice adored McDormand's performance, though she had one objection. "I didn't go barefoot in the house," she told her son. "I never went barefoot in the house." Critics praised Almost Famous, and Crowe won the Oscar for Best Original Screenplay, but it flopped at the box office. It got slaughtered, Crowe remembered, by a re-release of The Exorcist from 1973. Crowe chuckled and added, "So 1973 comes back to pound us, and our little movie about 1973, it really didn't take off until people discovered the video." Over the years, several Broadway producers had approached Crowe about turning Almost Famous into a musical. It is, after all, a movie about falling in love with music. And its soundtrack, including Simon and Garfunkel's America, Joni Mitchell's River, Lynyrd Skynyrd's Simple Man, The Beach Boys' Feel Flows, Clarence Carter's Slip Away, Todd Rundgren's It Wouldn't Have Made Any Difference, and Elton John's Tiny Dancer has the makings of a hit jukebox musical, the kind of show in which old hits are shoehorned into a plot. The audience has plenty to drink, they sing and dance, go home happy, and the cash register rings. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.